Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
Thanks. Look, I'd also like to thank Grace for bringing my slides into this century. So I'm a middle-aged woman. How I had them set out, you can only imagine. But thanks very much, Grace. Thank you. So I'm actually going to be spending the next few minutes talking to you about safe injury interpretation. And what I mean by safe is to keep ourselves safe when we're recording it, and also to keep the children that we're seeing safe. So, Petrificus Totalis, does anybody remember the bit who cast this spell in Harry Potter? So Hermione froze poor Neville Longbottom. And I think that's how most people feel when we think about non-accidental injury in the emergency department. But I'm hopefully going to give you a bit of an antidote. So as well as working in Sunshine Emergency Department, which I would describe as an eventful emergency department, I also work for this service along with Joe. And having a foot in two workspaces has actually given me a really helpful perspective, which I hope to share with you. So part of the antidote, I think, includes understanding some of the forensic terms, and particularly some of the loaded forensic terms. If you use them in your descriptions or your impression, understand what that means to people that are non-medical that might be reading it. Okay. I'm also going to go through some of the important bits of evidence, kind of almost like a bubble wrap type of thing for bruises and fractures, but really talk to you about what's the evidence out there for the types of injuries we might see. And then I'll be really interested at the end to share with you a couple of reflections, but I'd be really interested to hear on yours as well. So the first thing I'd say if you see a child with an injury in the emergency department or an acute setting is to describe what you see. There are many different formats for doing it, but describe what you see, don't diagnose it. Okay? So if you see, for example, a circular injury on the arm and you think it could look like a bite, it could just be a bruise, just call it a circular area of discoloration on the forearm. Don't call it a bite. Okay, you can certainly, if you think that it's a bruise or a bite, you can certainly put that in your impression or opinion, but don't write your diagnosis in your descriptions, okay? Because as we'll go through, it's not always easy to tell what an injury actually is, and that's okay. You don't need to say this is definitely a bruise, this is definitely an abrasion. You can actually have a little bit of room for saying it could be either. So there are some forensically loaded terms, and I'll go through that. You can essentially get a forensic definition of any of these terms from a forensic textbook or the internet, but I'll go through some of the key differences and explain to you why they are interpreted differently for non-medical professionals working in this area. So as you know, forensics talks about an opinion to do with the forces that cause the injury, the timing of the injury, and also the mechanism. Okay, so timing is getting more and more grey as we know a little bit more about forensic medicine. 20 years ago, I was aging bruises. We now know that we can't age bruises. Okay, so timing is becoming more and more grey as we know more about this. But those are the three things that we try and give some opinion about if we give a forensic opinion about an injury. So a bruise, we all know what a bruise is, but we all know as well that a bruise can occur at a point away from the point of impact. So it's usually blunt force trauma, but we all know through medicine or working in health that you can have an impact somewhere and get bruising somewhere else. Okay, do I need to convince you, or do we think that's a fact? We know that that can happen. Okay. This is opposed to an abrasion or a graze. An abrasion essentially means pressure or blunt force trauma plus movement. Okay, pressure plus movement. That's what you're implying when you say that. And it usually means that the impact has happened at that point that you see the injury. Does that make sense? So there's quite a key difference between describing a bruise and an abrasion, really just from point of impact and how the mechanism may have occurred. I've actually put this slightly confronting picture down the bottom here. So the second picture lower down is actually of a child's neck. And this child had a combination of bruises and abrasions within that area of injury. So that's not uncommon to get different types of injuries within the same area of injury. I didn't describe every single injury because there must be like 20 to 30 plus different angles of injury there. So if you describe an overall area with multiple areas within it as linear areas of bruising and abrasion, that's okay. All right, you don't need to describe every single 1 millimeter linear area. That's okay to do that. We know that a laceration is the tearing or splitting of skin and mucosa due to blunt force trauma. And this is in opposition to incised wounds. And there are some key features of incised wounds and lacerations that make them different to do with the edges, their surrounds, and their contents. Again, pretty standard stuff in forensic literature. But essentially, it's really important that you make the differentiation between incision, which is sharp force trauma, and laceration, if you're sure that that's what you're seeing. If you're not sure, it's okay to call that an open wound and to say that this could be a laceration or an incision. You're welcome to take a guess at this injury here, whether that's an incision or a laceration. There's no wrong answer. I think it could be either. So if I was describing this in the emergency department, I would call this like a linear horizontal open wound over the vermilion border. I know how it happened. This was basically a pair of scissors opened up onto the face. So it's an incision, it's sharp force trauma. But if this kid came in with no history, I wouldn't be able to tell whether it's a laceration or incision just purely based on the examination alone. So just be careful how you use those terms. And I've just put in a description of a stab wound. Don't worry, I don't have pictures of stab wounds. But essentially, the classic description is that the depth is longer or greater than the length. Quite a difficult thing to establish in clinical practice, and certainly when you've got an alive, awake patient. But certainly, that's a classic description of a stab wound. So I would hope part of the antidote, essentially, is to use broad terms. And we're encouraged to do this in our forensic reports as well. When you're describing injuries in an acute paediatric setting, use broad terms. Describe, don't diagnose, okay? If you can, use a body diagram. Take photographs with the scale included if you have access to photography. And just do clear, factual, contemporaneous notes, okay? So if it goes through to a medico-legal process, what they're looking for is that you've kept notes at the time of seeing the patient. Okay, so date, write down the time. Because then you can say that you've written these notes at the time that you actually saw the patient. And if you're in a situation where you've got child protection or the police that have attended with the child and the family, don't say to the police or child protection anything that you would not say in court. Okay? So they will often push you for an opinion or encourage you to say, you know, I had a child protection worker say to me recently, I'd like to know the age of the person that hit this child. I was like, I don't know if I can really help you with that. So just be really clear about what you can say. If you can't give mechanism, you can't give mechanism. If all you can say, this child has bruising and they're well to go home, that's all you can say. If all you can say, this is a small baby with a facial bruise, they need to be investigated for further investigation, that's all you can say. Do not be put into a situation where you say something or stretch beyond your expertise or say something you're not comfortable with. Okay, because once you say it to police or child protection, it's on record. Okay. So evidence-based practice, as you can imagine, there's not many randomised controlled trials in child protection work, but essentially what we have got is observational data and also some quite novel ways of looking at the information that we've got with forming expert consensus panel groups that essentially look at cases and say, okay, well, what are the guidelines? What does expert opinion say about this and how should we investigate it? So in terms of bruising and the red flags, children that are not mobile, and as we talked about this in Nikki's talk, the most vulnerable group, children that are not walking and not moving, so infants are the most vulnerable group. Bruising away from bony prominences or uniform or pattern shape or multiple bruised areas also concerning. But there's also this concept in the literature of the 10 concept, which is bruising on the torso, ears or neck. Extremely, extremely unusual to get accidentally, particularly in the preschool population. So torso, ears and neck. And the other thing I would add in there is literature also says that genital bruising is incredibly, incredibly hard to get accidentally. So if you have a pre-verbal child that's got genital bruising, I would encourage you to take that extremely seriously. There are some papers that essentially put together papers for which children with certain types of bruising under 23 months we would investigate. So that information is out there. I can't put it on a very detailed slide, but the group with the first author, Wood et al., it's an American group, have actually produced guidelines for which children with which bruises under this age that you should investigate. If we come on to fractures now, essentially, as Nikki said, that the most common non-accidental injury fracture is actually a long bone diaphyseal fracture. So not a classic metaphyseal lesion, not a sternal fracture, not a posterior fracture, but the most common non-accidental injury is what we see all the time. 85% of kids will have an accidental fracture at some point. But 80% of abuse fractures occur in the very small age group, the same thing that Nikki said. So the younger you are, the more likely you are to actually have an abusive fracture as part of your injury pattern. So we have to look carefully for it. And again, the Wood group have put together indications, if you're interested to look at it later, essentially for which children under the age of 2, with what particular fractures you would actually investigate. And pretty much children under 12 months, if they've got any fracture, they should have extended investigations to look for occult injury. The observational data, again, reflects that diaphyseal fractures are the most common, by 4-1 for metaphyseal fractures. So I know that we all think that classic metaphyseal fractures are the main thing that happens in inflicted injury. It's not. It's actually, as we said, long bone diaphyseal fractures. And this is just a slide to remind us that not all metaphyseal fractures are actually inflicted. So on the left here, if I can, that's a classic metaphyseal lesion. And on the right of that is basically an example of a metaphyseal fracture that is not an inflicted injury fracture. So fractures caused by different forces. And then the last thing I was just going to say about fracture evidence is that this actually came out last week. Our director sent this round. And essentially what the Wood group, this is the same group that put together guidelines for bruises and fractures and which children to investigate. They looked at all children under the age of 2 that had non-motor vehicle accidents, injuries. So if you weren't involved in an MVA, and you had an injury under 2, you essentially had extended investigations. Okay, so and looking for occult bone injury. Of the children less than 5 months, 1 in 4 had an occult bone injury if they had any injury and then had a skeletal survey. Okay, so 1 in 4 children, nearly 25% of children under the age of 5 months, if they had any injury, when you had a skeletal survey, they had an occult bone injury. Okay, that's very, very, very high. And that just reminds us to be incredibly careful of the most vulnerable group. Okay, so if you, this is the kind of stuff that we use to base our guidelines on. And you can certainly go to the Victorian Forensic Paediatric Medical Service and look at our guidelines. And we've used this kind of information to put our guidelines together. If you're really into it, then the British College of Paediatrics and Child Health have got an area called Child Protection Evidence, and this is actually the old Core Info group. They've actually put together all of the evidence for child protection related issues, put it into categories, 15 different categories, and they've basically summarised all of the current evidence. But the thing I really want to say is that non-accidental injury can look like any injury. And I think we all know that, and that's actually the message that we're trying to get across. And I know you guys will probably be sick of stories at the end of the 3 days, but I'm going to tell you a story. And the story I'm going to briefly tell you is of a little girl who was 4 or 5 who came to the emergency department with the metal end of an ashtray. You know the metal grid on the end of an ashtray? basically stuck on a finger, like her, I think her fourth finger. But she'd been left at home for several hours and not brought when it happened. So by the time she got to the emergency department, her finger was really, really swollen with this metal grid stuck on the end. And there was no way we could get it off without causing essentially a degloving injury. Okay. Obviously, that's a concern that she was left at home for a while. But the thing that also concerned us is that we were going to give her some sedation because obviously this was not going to happen in an awake 4 or 5-year-old. And asking mum the fasting history, she had no idea when the child had last eaten. The brother who came with her, who was about 8 or 9, said, I think I gave her some noodles a few hours ago, I'm not sure. And when we went into the treatment room to actually start just trying to remove this metal thing on the end of her, her mum basically just left and went outside for a cigarette and wasn't even there to support the young person. So there's no guideline for what to do with a kid with an ashtray stuck on the end of a finger. So it's not the injury, it's actually the context. Okay, so what's the context of what I'm seeing? Okay, and that's obviously this is a child who had child protection procedures escalated. So they're challenging consultations, non-accidental injury consultations. This is not something you go to work and have a leap in your step about doing. These are difficult. Patients don't like you. You're going to have a difficult conversation. Sometimes we're too busy or too tired to see it. Okay, and understanding our own cognitive biases, I'm actually upset that I'm missing the cognitive biases talk, which is happening at the same time, is incredibly important. So you need to think that we protect ourselves with how we think. We see a perspective that fits our view of the world. And doing things like confirmation bias and groupthink, very, very easy things to fall into because all we want to do is protect ourselves. That's how the brain works. But child protection issues in Australia are rising. 1 in 32 children in Australia from last year's health and welfare data received child protection services. This is something you see in your weekly practice, okay? And even though it's difficult, we have to have our eyes open to it. I'll share with you a couple of reflections and I'd really like to hear from you. But probably a couple of ways in which I've changed my practice that I ask about family violence routinely. I ask broad questions to families I see in the emergency department because you never know what's going to be told to you. I'm very, very careful with babies under 6 months with any injury and very, very careful with any pre-verbal toddler with unusual bruising or injuries. Okay, I think that this could happen with any child that I see. I think one of the other things that we need to think about is how we look after ourselves. Vicarious trauma is a thing in all lines of work, but especially in this line of work. We need to look after ourselves, we need to look after each other, and we just need to make sure that we're the best we can be so we can look after the kids that we're seeing. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bindu. What a great talk, reminding us of how important it is to be thinking about NAI and to be cautious and mindful of what we write and how we document to enable these children to be best taken care of. Any questions?
Well, if you want to see some of the resources that were spoken about in this talk, people have been posting those on Twitter, which is amazing, so take a look. A few questions came up, particularly around now we're using electronic health records much more frequently, and the ability to draw and document injury is actually much more challenging when we have to use our words as opposed to our hand-drawn pictures, and if you had any tips around that.
No, I don't. I'm a middle-aged woman, so I struggle with technology generally, but I don't. I think you just make the best of the tools that you've got and just describe and annotate what you see. If you can supplement it with some photography into the electronic medical record, I think that does help. But always just remember to include a scale because a photograph without a scale is not as helpful.
That's a great tip. Thank you. We would like to open up the floor to any additional questions that may come from the audience here. Is there Any questions about, sure, one at the back there.
How do you actually ask people whether there's domestic violence at home? My experience has been to ask, and I don't actually always trust the answers.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think part of this work is not always believing what you're told, but it depends on the situation, but I'll start with a child-focused question. So is there anything else that could impact on your child's health and well-being? And it's incredible, actually, what people will tell you with that question. And then just say, just ask people, look, I ask everybody that comes with this type of presentation, is there anybody that could have physically hurt your child, anybody that has physically hurt you in the last 12 months? And it really is amazing what people say.
Do we have some more questions, and they can be Fernie speakers?
Just regarding photography, I don't think it is possible to put a photograph onto the EMR in my place anyway. Is it ethical to take it with your own phone? It seems very
I wouldn't do that. I would not do that, yeah. Unless you can immediately upload it onto the medical record, and RCH has got that facility to take a picture and immediately upload it. So if you don't, I wouldn't do it for a couple of reasons. One is your own well-being. I don't think it's a good thing to have as an association. And I think the second reason is that it might actually push a drive to get photography in your hospital and department. Yeah, so police can often come and do photography. So that's what a lot of places will do.
I was just wondering, so you're talking about the risk factors and the things that you look out for when you're thinking about NAI. So just wondering how often you're surprised by the fact that you find something, say on an investigation or something like that, you actually thought the parents were very trustworthy, and then you find something.
Happens rarely, but it does happen. So basically, that we've all been burnt by basically having a cognitive bias and an empathy with the parent and the family, and then not wanting to see or not wanting to investigate because we've actually got like a collaborative relationship with the parent. And actually, it's one of the things I didn't say, that it's a very, very different consultation feeling. It doesn't feel good, okay? And also, basically, when you're working in the emergency department, I've got a very different interaction with the family than if I'm working with a family in the forensic setting. And often, if I see a family in the emergency setting and I think there may be inflicted injury, I'll often get on the phone and speak to one of my colleagues at VFPMS that hasn't seen the patient, so I can get like a cold perspective. So, because then I can say, this is a 5-monther with facial bruising. I know I should investigate them, but the parents seem really nice and I don't want to do it. So actually having a conversation with someone that's not biased because they've seen the family is very helpful.
Maybe one last question.
You mentioned that non-accidental injuries are on the rise. Could that be because we're better at finding them, or is there a reason why there is an increase? And if there is an actual increase, is there something as practitioners we can do
Yeah, so I think it's the child protection services. The number of children receiving child protection services has increased. The majority of children have a notification or substantiated notification made because of emotional maltreatment. So that doesn't just mean physical injury. That includes emotional maltreatment, physical abuse, neglect, and obviously sexual abuse being the smallest. But emotional maltreatment is by far the commonest group of children in who are receiving child protection services.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you very much, Bindu.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Thank you.